The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf, your source for total wealth management. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of Roe, his guests, and callers. Now let's begin the show. Here's your host, Roe Diefendorf.
Thank you for joining me on Three-Dimensional Wealth. I'm your host, Roe Diefendorf, and I'm here today with Andy Hyman, and we're going to be talking about life settlements, an exit strategy from your life insurance policy. And Andy is an expert in the area. He's been in the life insurance industry for over 25 years. He is the president of Integrated Plan Designs, and they specialize in life settlements and employee benefits. And I've known Andy for a long time, and so who better to have on the show today than Andy himself? Welcome.
Thank you, Roe.
I want to ask you, in a nutshell, what are life settlements?
Well, life settlements are a relatively new phenomenon. It's a secondary market for life insurance, just like a secondary market for mortgages, Fannie Mae's, where a life insurance policy can now be sold into a secondary market rather than being turned back to an insurance company and surrendered for the cash value. Mm-hmm. And many times the value of that policy will in the sale of the market, in the secondary market, will exceed the cash value that one would have gotten by just surrendering the policy. So it's certainly an option that anyone who owns a policy that doesn't need it anymore for whatever reason should consider rather than dropping it. And it works, by the way, for both term and permanent insurance.
Okay. But what's the relationship between viaticals, maybe you can explain that, and life settlements, and maybe the history of how we've gotten to where we are today in the industry?
Okay, well, viatical started about 20 years ago. Viatical, for those people that are listening that are not familiar with that term, was a market where people had less than 2 years of life expectancy and were terminally ill. And individuals were buying their insurance policies during their lifetime to give them money for their last expenses. And it started out for AIDS, people with AIDS, and people who had terminal cancer initially. What happened from there is that slowly people started to realize that life insurance policies had an intrinsic value that was greater than the cash in the policy if that policy was held to maturity or until someone passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So slowly what's happened is that it's evolved into a market where now major funds are popping up all over the world and raising money specifically to buy life insurance policies, no differently than a fund raises money to buy bonds or mutual funds.
Well, is it better than viaticals? Is it different? I mean, how does the life settlement then become the extension?
Well, I don't think you could say it's better or worse than a viatical.
Is it the same, just now that you don't need to be terminally ill?
Well, actually, you don't need to be sick at all.
Yeah.
Your policy has value irrespective of what your health status is at a particular point in time. Obviously, the sicker you are, the closer the value is to the face value of the policy. But where a viatical, you had to have less than 2 years to live, when you're dealing in life settlements, you're not dealing with that. You're dealing with, you know, up to 20 years to live in some cases.
Mm-hmm. When you're selling the policy, though, when insurance began way back, there's a principle called insurable interest. And that's the principle that the beneficiary should have a stake in the well-being of the insured. And I go back to the Britain's Gambling Act, I think it was 1774, which made betting on the lives of strangers illegal. What's the difference today? What makes this any different?
Well, you're not gambling on a person is selling their own life insurance policy, the act that you're referring to back in those olden days in Great Britain was I'd buy a life insurance policy on your life without your consent.
Okay.
And then, in the worst case scenario, I'd have you bumped off and I'd get the proceeds of the life insurance policy. So, insurable interest is a different concept. The insurable interest means that the individual who owns the life insurance policy has an insurable interest in the life of the person themselves, so they're not likely to have that person killed for the benefit of the insurance policies, like a son or a daughter or a wife, or the insured has an insurable interest in themselves, so an insured can buy an insurance policy on themselves for the benefit of, say, a creditor, because they owe money. And then once that loan is paid off and they don't owe that money anymore, they can choose to turn around and sell that policy rather than surrender it. And that way they can recoup the money that they've paid for that life insurance policy and maybe even make a profit.
It's interesting because you made, I think you said the phrase, something about it turns life insurance into an asset.
Unquestionably. A person's insurability has always been an asset. It's just a question of how you quantified it. Now with the life settlement market, you can quantify to some degree, obviously we don't know when anyone's going to die, but you can quantify the value of your insurability. And it's a fairly complicated value to put on something, but it's just like valuing a piece of property or any other asset that isn't readily marketable.
Now, it sounds like it's a good thing. I mean, the extension of the early days of insurance when an insurance company would set up a reserve. The reserve would be there to fund the ultimate death claim. And yet, in the 1800s, when someone said, well, I no longer need the insurance, the reserve went back to the insurance company. And so they had a windfall. And so the extension of that then became 1906, the Armstrong Commission. Then said, wait a second, if the insurance company is setting up a reserve to fund this death claim, then if they no longer need the insurance, then the insurance company no longer needs the reserve, hence they would send the cash or the reserve back to the insured. And then hence it had a much greater value because now it had a cash surrender value and, in fact, could be borrowed. And so you had now a loan value. And so policies went, after the Armstrong Commission, had a much greater value. But isn't this the extension then that makes the policies even more valuable? Because in the marketplace, if there's a cash surrender value, and from what you've said, Andy, that the cash surrender value may be less than what the asset value is or the market value in the, community, investment community. So this now becomes a more valuable asset rather than less valuable.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. I think it is definitely an extension of that, and I think it is definitely properly used in the interest of the consumer and makes life insurance a much better quote-unquote investment than it was prior to having this secondary market. Now, the fact is that that's a very controversial point at this point in time, and I think insurance companies are reacting to the life settlement market much like they may have reacted to the Armstrong Commission back in 1906, where they felt that awarding the cash value to the insured rather than their keeping it wasn't such a good idea at the time. So I think there are a lot of analogies, actually, exactly 100 years later, as we see.
That's right. There was an interesting article back in the Wall Street Journal, August 9th. It says, life insurance faced the future grudgingly. And they say, life insurance has long been priced on the belief that a sizable share of policies would be allowed to lapse because the customer could no longer afford the premiums and no longer needed the coverage. But now, if the policies are instead kept in force by outside investors, what happens?
Well, that's exactly right. The insurance company is going to have to pay off that death benefit. excuse me, and they're not going to be able to make windfall profit. That article, by the way, of August 9th that you're speaking about in the Wall Street Journal was fascinating because it did lay out the positions very well of the insurance companies versus the consumer, in my opinion. It's really an interesting conundrum for the insurance company. It really is.
Well, the point is the life insurance policy the property of the insured? And if it is the property of the insured, does he have the right to sell it like any other asset?
Well, those of us that are independent believe strongly that the life insurance policy is the property of the insured and that the insured has the right to sell it and maximize the value of it. The number of insurance companies, and I don't want to get too political about this, but a number of insurance companies have taken the position that they're afraid of that this will create abuses,
mm-hmm.
and life insurance will not be used for the purposes that that it was traditionally used for. I disagree with that. I agree with your statement that life insurance is an asset of the insured.
Well, maybe you can comment on the size of the market as you see it. I mean, I read another article that said out of 37 million Americans 65 years of age and older have a life insurance face value of $500 billion, and at least $100 billion is which to be deemed resalable. And so it looks like, Andy, there is going to be a huge demand for life settlements, and it's only going to increase.
I would agree, Roey, and I think that's a question that we can hold off from the start the next segment with.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more Three-Dimensional Wealth, so stay tuned.
Business information you need, from the stock market to starting and managing your business. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management, financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
Why is Pepsi cooler than Coke? Why are iPods so popular? In 2005, how can you launch a successful brand? Want to know? Learn about the fascinating and intriguing world of graphic design and branding on Design Matters with Debbie Millman. Every Friday at 12 Pacific Standard Time, Debbie Millman will provide you with a provocative look into the stimulating world of design as it intersects with contemporary culture. Hear what the experts have to say about creating, maintaining, and launching a brand in today's challenging marketplace. Join us every Friday at 12 Pacific Standard Time for Design Matters with Debbie Millman, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
What I want to be when I grow up, by Johnny Mike.
Dad, it's John. I got the promotion. We'll call him John Jr.
You'll speak over 500 million words in your lifetime, but none of them will be as important as the words you use to tell your six-year-old he has cancer. CureSearch.org connects you to the most comprehensive research and advice on childhood cancer and to other families who know exactly what you're going through. CureSearch.org. You're not as alone as you feel. Brought to you by CureSearch and the Ad Council.
The Bottom Line in Business Talk. Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roey Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roey Diefendorf.
I'm here with Andy Hyman, a life insurance wizard, and we're discussing life settlements, an exit strategy for your life insurance policy. Just before the break, we were talking, Andy, about the size of this market.
Well,
where do you see it going?
Well, it's not just me how I see it going. Sanford Bernstein sees this market going from where it currently is, approximately $13 billion of policies, to $160 billion of policy sales by 2030. That's a fairly significant increase over a 20-year period of time.
And what do they attribute that growth from?
Well,
is there a particular reason why they see that happening?
Well, I think, you know, there are $9 trillion of life insurance in force. And as the baby boomers get older, the policies that they bought when they were young, some of them are going to be held to death, and some of them people are going to sell. And in the past, a lot of those policies would have lapsed, as we touched on before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think very few of those policies will actually lapse. As the public becomes more aware of the existence of the life settlement market, they're far more likely to turn around and resell that policy into the secondary market as opposed to just let it lapse for no value or minimal value.
All right. So then who's right for this? Who are the people that would want to sell their policies or could sell them?
Well, it's changing dramatically over the last 2 or 3 years. About 2-3 years ago, a policy was only saleable if a person had 5 to 7 years of life expectancy.
Okay.
Today, a policy is saleable if someone has 20 years of life expectancy. So that's a huge difference. Usually, you have to be over 65 years old in today's world or have a health problem.
So actuarially, you'd look 65. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Actuarially, you'd look 65 is correct. And if you think about it, an average 65-year-old probably does have about a 20-year life expectancy
mm-hmm.
today. If a person is under 65, though, and they don't need a policy, they should really consider whether they could sell it now or whether or not they should hold the policy for another couple of years till they get to be 65 and calculate the premium that they'd have to pay versus how much they could sell it for in two or three or four or five years if they're baby boomers.
That's an interesting concept, because in my mind I had sort of the break point of anyone who's under 65 would not be a quote prospect for this. And yet what you're saying is you could get somebody who's 62, 63 and the premium paid would be more than recouped upon the sale a few years later, and they would still retain the coverage for those years and be insured.
Exactly right. And you got to remember that the value of an insurance policy should be tested at the point in time that exists today, not at what it was when the policy was purchased. If I'm 60 years old today and I've had a policy for 20 years, just because I can't sell that policy today when I'm 60, I need to look at how much it's going to cost me to keep that policy in force between now and the time I turn 65 in order to really calculate the value of that policy.
You know what happens, Andy, what you're saying is it makes you take the blinders off. I mean, we were always taught that the value of the contract is the interpolated terminal reserve, and so when you're doing your analysis, that's the number you're looking at. But you just introduced a third factor that blows away all of our old methodology of doing our work.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. I think it's going to have as much impact over the next 25 years in the insurance business as the Armstrong Act had from 1906 to the present. It totally changes the value of a life insurance policy.
Okay. How about minimum size? Is there a minimum size that we should be looking at?
Well, today, there's a ready market for any policy over about $250,000, $250,000. But again, like any other,
I was under the impression it was considerably higher. I, you know, my mind, I had $1 million as the minimum.
Well, you know, that probably 2 years ago that was the case.
Okay.
But today it's come down to 250, and I suspect it's going to come down much lower than that. And that's as these funds are set up to buy policies. They don't care whether it's, you know, they're not buying it for one policy or two policies or 10 policies or even 1,000 policies. So they don't care. It's either a good deal or a bad deal.
It's interesting because as a consortium buys a group of policies, the greater the number in the portfolio, the more consistent the return will be.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Works just like a mutual fund. And it's a way for them to hedge the risk and give a predictable return to their investors.
What about health of someone? So I've got somebody who's 65 who's got $1 million policy, but is in great health. Make a difference, or is it someone who's got something wrong?
Well, obviously a person's life expectancy relative to the amount of premium that has to be paid to the time that person dies is going to determine the value of that policy. The arbitrage that's created is going to determine the value of that policy. So if you've got a person that's 65 and healthy and they have a life expectancy of 90, versus a person who's 65 and has something wrong with them with a life expectancy of 80, the person who's got the life expectancy of 80, that same policy is going to be more valuable for that 65-year-old that has the 15-year versus the 25-year life expectancy.
Okay. And then, of course, I think a final factor is obviously it's someone who their current insurance no longer is working for them. Right? Something has changed. They no longer need to indemnify some kind of loss. And so they say, time for this to go, and this is the alternative that we can now explore.
Well, that's right. For an existing insurance policy, it would be a change in need. It could the change in need could be a number of factors. People bought insurance to ensure their children's college education, or to ensure that their spouse would have enough money to raise the family if something were to happen to them. Now they get to the point where the children are all grown up, and they don't need that insurance anymore, and this now becomes an alternative. There's a lot of talk about what's going to happen with the estate tax laws and how much estate taxes are going to be due. I know the amount changes going into next year, and that may free up some insurance for people who have bought insurance based on higher estate taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many reasons why someone's insurance may not be needed as needed as it used to be.
All right, so I don't need the insurance. I don't want it. It's got, you know, it's no longer affordable. The policies that I can use, policies that are available, you mentioned before, but it's more specifically, give us the names of them.
Well, almost any life insurance policy has value. It doesn't matter whether it's a whole life, universal life, term insurance, second to die. Virtually any insurance policy has value. It's just a question of what that value is. And that's where the process comes in from the consumer's point of view. They want to have somebody that is going to help them determine the value of that policy.
Okay. Now, at one time we had a conversation, Andy, you said something about group life conversions, which was an interesting concept. How does that play in, and how is it used in life settlements?
Well, for people that are retiring, if they don't need the life insurance, usually they don't, even if they've had life insurance their entire business career, they don't usually think about taking over that life insurance policy. But if you're retiring at 65 and you have group insurance that's convertible on a standard basis to permanent insurance, that permanent insurance is an asset, even if you don't need the insurance. So something that people who are retiring should consider is whether they should take over their term insurance, their group term life insurance, and convert it to permanent insurance, and then look into whether, you know, how much they could get to sell the policy.
Boy, that's something that you don't want to neglect when you're doing your financial planning, especially for some of the corporate executives who have substantial amounts of, you know, group insurance.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are hidden assets all over the place in insurance. It's really a wonderful financial tool that is very misunderstood.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit, Andy. Who's buying these policies?
Well, policies started off being purchased by individuals. Today, that doesn't happen so much. Policies are being purchased by hedge funds. Policies are being purchased by mutual funds. Funds, as I mentioned before, are being set up all over the world specifically to buy life insurance policies. I know of at least two countries that are setting where mutual funds are being set up in Germany and in Australia, where a lot of money is being invested into funds specifically to buy life insurance policies.
And that's, I guess, primarily because the proceeds that they would receive, if they were done, I assume, in the United States, would be taxable, whereas those proceeds might be, under German law, tax-free.
Well, the tax consequences are very fluid, because it is such a new market. And certainly the people that are setting up these funds are taking that into account. It probably doesn't affect the seller of the policy very much, except as far as the value of the policy goes.
Mm-hmm.
If they can find a fund in a country where the death benefit is going to be tax-free to that fund, obviously that fund is capable of paying more money for that policy than a fund that is set up in a country where the death benefit would be taxable.
You get tremendously greater leverage, sure.
Exactly.
All right, so then they're pricing the policies. What are the mechanics of pricing a policy for me to sell?
Well, this is really where the rubber hits the road, in my opinion. There are many, many people out there trying to buy life insurance policies. And for someone who is interested in selling a policy, they really have to take responsibility for determining how much that policy is worth. No different than if they were selling their own house. The first person that came through the door and made them an offer, that wouldn't be necessarily the person they would sell it to. If a person is selling a life insurance policy, the first thing they should do is they should find out what their life expectancy is. That's the most important thing. They should retain someone who is expert in determining that to help them to determine the value of their life insurance policy.
All right. Well, we're going to pick up on that because I think this is a key point. And so stay tuned. We're going to be talking more about life settlements with Andy Hyman and Three-Dimensional Wealth.
More and more people are starting their day with informative, focused business talk. Top experts. Today's business issues. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
As a financial planner, do your clients really read all that computer-generated boilerplate text in an analysis? The FPS Financial Planning Software is designed for you to show your clients a concise and easy-to-follow report of their financial needs. The FPS system guides your clients to clearly see any needs that they may have in the achieving of their goals. Clients are guided to a decision rather than just reading the analysis. For a free copy of the FPS system, call 1-800-245-1991. Once again, that's 1-800-245-1991.
investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Are you looking for a unique perspective on today's market from an experienced economist? Well, look no further. Listen to The Economic Contrarian with host Mike Norman every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on Business America Radio. Mike and his guests will discuss new trends in the marketplace as well as emerging companies and opportunities. So if you want in-depth analysis from a contrarian point of view, don't miss The Economic Contrarian Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
The Bottom Line in Business Talk. Voice America Business.
We now return to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roy Diefendorf. Direct your questions and comments to www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now the host of Three-Dimensional Wealth, Roy Diefendorf.
Our show for today is entitled Life Settlements, Exit Strategy from Your Life Insurance. And we're here with the president of Integrated Plan Designs, Andy Hyman. Andy, before our break, we were talking about, determining, how do you determine the price of a policy, a life insurance policy that someone would sell to the secondary market. And you made a comment and you said, well, first thing you'd have to do is find out your life expectancy. I mean, how does someone do that, the common person?
Well, a person can do it themselves. There are companies that have been set up all over the country to evaluate people's life expectancies, just like there are funds that have been set up to buy the policies.
Let me just break in. Typically, I think of the companies that would, be there to figure out your life expectancy or the life insurance companies themselves. But you're not talking about that, are you?
No, okay. I'm not talking about the life insurance companies. I'm talking about companies specifically set up to evaluate an individual's life expectancy separate from the life insurance company. That the hedge fund or the fund that's potentially buying the policy is going to look at when they're determining how much they're willing to pay for that policy. A third party, if you will.
Okay.
Just like if what I think the individual needs to understand is that this process that needs to be managed, and they're not expected to know who these companies are or who the funds are. They need to find an advisor who has done this, who is involved in this marketplace, and who can lead them through the process of determining the value for of their policy. The key for the individual is understanding who that advisor represents. Does he represent the buyer of the policy, the fund, or does he represent the individual who is selling the policy? And the key for the individual is to get somebody who represents their interests. I think the easiest way to look at that is the person willing to disclose the process to the individual? Are they willing to disclose the how much they're going to get paid, how they're going to get paid? That's a key issue in today's world, because there are many people that
why wouldn't someone?
Well, it's a good question. I think greed
sounds logical to me.
Well, greed is probably the simple answer. If you know a policy is worth, say you have $1 million policy and that policy is worth $300,000 on the open market, and you know that the person has $50,000 to $75,000 of cash value, and you could offer that person $200,000 and they'd be very happy, then there's $100,000 of profit in there for somebody. That's usurious. That's too much profit.
But that goes back to actually acting on behalf of the client.
Oh, there is no question about it.
Because the duty should be to get multiple offers, I would think, and make sure that you know who these buyers are and verify that they can, you know, they have the cash to do the deal, and you know, determine where these proceeds are going to be held, and that I'm sure they're held, you know, in escrow.
Oh, there's no question. And the value of the broker or the agent in the transaction is to coordinate that effort on behalf of the policyholder. The policyholder has to be, everything about the transaction has to be disclosed to the policyholder. The value of the fund that's buying the policy, how the proceeds are being dispersed, how their escrow account works, how much the commission is, who is in fact getting commissions on the sale, are there multiple commissions, are there, is there some kind of steering going on where someone is being incentivized to steer policies to a particular fund or a particular, carrier.
It's interesting, there was an article just this last week in one of the trade journals, and the title of it says it's all in the motive. And the question is, what's the difference between what you're doing and investor-owned life insurance? If I do business with you, I'd feel like a traitor to my industry. So I mean, this is the question, and you know, the concern is that by consummating a life settlement, this is the agent, would be contributing to the spread of investor or stranger-owned life insurance, which their companies and the professional organizations, like NAFA, so vigorously oppose. And so the article is saying, well, it's all in the motive. He said that first and foremost, it should be to benefit the policyholder. That's what the life settlement is about, and it should meet the policyholder's clear and present need for liquidity, and therefore can be viewed as an extension of the policy. So the life settlement is an extension of the policy. So he said, you know, it's in the motive, and yet the insurance companies, some of them actually discourage any of their agents from discussing that at all.
Well, you know, it clearly is in the motive, and as you know, the insurance company's motives aren't necessarily 100% pure. If they have what's called lapse-supported insurance policy, they do not want those policies sold because they're going to have to pay the death benefit, as we mentioned before. They want those policies lapsed. One of the ways insurance companies can discourage the sale of policies is by discouraging their agents from participating and helping the policyholder to sell their policies.
Mm-hmm. But something must be not kosher, because I mean, we've got Spitzer's complaint. There's been fraud in these. I mean, how does that play in? Something's not right.
that's the flip side of the same coin. That's the abuse by that I was alluding to before. That's the abuse of the person who's helping the insured devalue the policy.
Okay.
Elliot Spitzer's complaint talked to policies where the commissions were 50 to 75% of the value that the policy was being purchased for.
Oh.
So the benefit wasn't going to the insured. The benefit was going to the person who manipulated, if you will, the sale.
Yeah, I think from my understanding of the readings is that it was also that it really was didn't hit the open market, so to speak, and that it really didn't have a chance to be priced.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
It was directed to one carrier, and that carrier alone, so there was no one else bidding on it.
Right. I mean,
what kind of auction if there's only one bidder, right?
Well, that doesn't make for a very good auction, does it?
No.
No, that's exactly right. And again, it falls on the policyholder, on the person who owns the asset, to make sure that they get the right guidance, and their best tool is full disclosure.
Okay, what about the states? I mean, life insurance is regulated by state, not by federal government, although federal government always would love to take over that jurisdiction. How do the states play into life settlements?
Well, this is a very interesting, very, very interesting area that is also being played out as it goes along. Right now, some states have laws that regulate life settlements, and some states don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some states are very in favor of life settlements, like Louisiana, and some states are against life settlements. And it's a political football, if you will. The insured cannot control the state and the regulations of the state. I think it goes back to the question that you raised early in this conversation, which was, who owns the insurance policy? The insured owns the insurance policy in every state.
Okay.
It is, again, up to the insured to make sure to maximize the value of their own asset.
Okay. And so, hence, if that you need to go back, and we're going to talk about that in our last section, to having what I call a life settlement broker or a life settlement facilitator in order to really make sure that the process is done correctly.
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to take one more break, but we'll be back with more of Three Dimensional Wealth, so stay tuned. Thank you.
Fresh, dynamic, and totally prepared for continuing business education. Business Talk Radio. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu. The education you need to succeed.
Built on a foundation of honorable intent, nonprofit organizations do more for our society and our economy than may be immediately obvious. These complex organizations provide goods and services to various sectors of our society, including sheltering the homeless and indigent, educating children, providing medical care, filling communities with art and music, tending victims in the wake of devastating natural disasters, and meeting the growing needs of America's youth in major cities throughout the country. But how much do we know about nonprofits, and what are we doing to support them? On New Thinking for Nonprofits, with host, philosopher, educator, corporate advisor, and scholarly coach to executives, Dr. Terry Macaluso, and her expert guests provide insight and understanding about nonprofit organizations. This sector of our society is a new social and economic force with extraordinary power and value. New Thinking for Nonprofits, with Dr. Terry Macaluso, broadcast each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. New Thinking for Nonprofits, your inside look at the people, the services, the resources, and the commitment to support our expanding social sector.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roe Diefendorf.
Welcome back. My guest for today is Andy Hyman, and he is the president of Integrated Plan Designs in Purchase, New York. We've been talking about life settlements, and I want to touch on the taxation of a life settlement. And I think it comes, from my understanding, in sort of three parts to the transaction. So maybe you can follow up and tell me what you know.
Okay. If you sell a an insurance policy and you make a profit, that profit is going to be taxable. There are a variety of ways of determining what that tax on that profit will be. Is it capital gains, or is it ordinary income? What I tell my clients is that they really need to speak with their tax advisors to determine if in their particular case it's capital gain or whether it's ordinary income. Insurance brokers and life settlement facilitators, if you will, are not, I don't believe, qualified to be accountants or attorneys.
Okay. But give me a guideline. I mean, I understand, at least to my knowledge, is if I have a policy, let me give you some numbers. Let's see if this is right. Let's say I have a $1 million policy and the value in the open market is $200,000.
Okay.
And I've paid in cumulative premiums $50,000. So $50,000 would be, in investment terms, my cost basis.
Right.
And my cash surrender value, or my interpolated terminal reserve, let's say, is $60,000. So I've got a cost basis of $50,000, $10,000. So the cost basis would be return of premium. That would be tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
The additional $10,000 of the $60,000 would be taxed as ordinary income, or in a surrender of a life insurance policy, if there is a profit on surrender or, quote, selling it back to the insurance company, that would be ordinary income. And the gain on top, or the $140,000 from the cash surrender value to the sale, could be potentially capital gains, or what you're saying is it might be ordinary income, and the jury is still out. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I think the jury is out, and I don't think there's any definitive answer to that question. There are some tax advisors that believe that if the policy has been held for more than the period of time necessary to make it capital gains, that it's a capital gain, and there are others that believe that it's ordinary income and is taxed the same way as the increase over the increase in cash value over the premium. Again, as I mentioned before, I don't really feel qualified to make that decision.
No, but it's another reason why you need to have professionals on your team in order to put this together.
Oh, there's no question. This is a very complicated, insurance is a complicated matter, and it's a complicated transaction, and you definitely need to have someone who's on your side, who you trust, who's going to be helping you through this.
Andy, I know your firm specializes in life settlements. I mean, I call you, quote, the facilitator, the life settlement facilitator. Is that a good phrase?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it is.
And as facilitator, I mean, we've talked a little about the process, but is part of your job, quote, creating an arbitrage? Is that part of your job as the facilitator, or does that come as a result of finding investors?
Well, I think both parts of that question, they're both right. It is your job as the facilitator to determine if there is a profit, or help the insured determine if there is a profit on their life insurance policy, or if they can get back, if there isn't a profit, if they can get back part of the money that they spent for that life insurance policy that is not needed any longer. That value, that arbitrage, if you will, is going to be created by the secondary market. When you look at the difference between the premium that has been paid for a particular policy and the amount the policy can be sold for. The key here is to understand the factors that go into valuing that policy from the point of view of the buyer. What's going to make that policy more valuable to the buyer? And we've touched on several of them. Life expectancy is one. The taxation to the buyer, the mutual fund or the hedge fund is another. And a third is going to be the ongoing premiums that are going to be due on that policy to keep that policy in force until the person were to pass away. So it's those factors that are going to, and as well as some others, that are going to determine how much a policy is worth. A good facilitator, using your word, will put together a model of what the policy should be worth, and then go out into the open market to see whether they can exceed that value. So when we price a policy, we price it based on how much we think that buyer should be able to get for that policy.
Okay. It's interesting because I think I heard you say something about we would determine how much of the policy is needed. I mean, that some people think all or none. You know, I have a $5 million policy. Well, if you only need $2 million, then maybe you can sell $3 million of your policy to help fund your remaining $2 million.
And there's no question about it.
A whole new idea there as well.
There's no question about it. In your insurability is an asset. And I know of people who are buying more insurance than they need today with the expectation that they'll sell part of that insurance over a period of time as they get closer to death to ultimately pay for the insurance that they need today. So that's kind of flipping it on its head from someone who has a policy they don't need to someone who needs insurance today. And how much insurance they'll actually buy.
Andy, fascinating concept there. One of the things that we were going to talk about, but I think we're out of time, was just the fiduciary responsibility, and do we owe it to our clients to bring this out? I think we do, and I'm glad we've had this conversation because it's an area that is unknown and untapped.
Oh, it's an area that is very unknown, Roey, and I appreciate your having me on. And I think it's an area that people should spend some time determining how much their life insurance is worth. They have a hidden asset here, and it could be worth a lot more money than they could have ever dreamed of.
All right. Andy, thanks for joining me this past hour. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, And I invite you to join me next week at the same time with more Three-Dimensional Wealth. Thank you.
Thank you, Roey.
Thank you for tuning in to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roey Diefendorf. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for more tips and strategies for achieving total wealth management on Three-Dimensional Wealth right here on The Bottom Line in Business Talk.